Grant settled in and looked intently at Rita.
Now you got my undivided attention. What are you people, anyway?
Humans, even as you and your friends are.
Listen, Rita, you're a nice lady, and your friends are all so nice it's a damn wonder you don't sprain your faces smiling. But don't try to blow smoke up an old door-busting magistrate's butt, all right? The hybrids say they're as human as we are, too.
They say they're as terrestrial as you are in origin, no? We are humans, derived from planet Earth. But all of us were born in space.
Not Australia? Well, if I hadn't seen you do some totally inexplicable things, right now I'd be expecting you to whip out a tinfoil hat shaped like the Great Pyramid and put it on.
You are quite a clever man, Grant, although you choose to mask it behind rough-hewn ways. Our current bodies were born in Australia. We were born in space. Our legends say that a giant red egg descended long ago from the heavens to the earth, to Australia. It broke open on impact. The survivors, white-skinned, emerged to eke out a life in the barren land. The egg decayed to form the red earth of the central desert.
She looked at him, gauging his reaction.
That was us, the crew. Our ship was the last survivor of a mighty star-faring fleet. The rest had all been destroyed in a battle with an enemy too terrible to remember. I pray I never do.
The wind began to die. Its last remnants whistled among the rocks and rustled the dried grass.
To survive, we had to adapt. We darked up over time. We learned the hunter-gatherer ways to enable us to stay alive in a harsh land. One which, I admit, was alien to our individual experience, even if our kind did spring from this soil. And from that point, as legend says, the elders of our people decreed that things must never change.
Why couldn't you use your technology to live? Or did you lose all your gear in the crash? Wouldn't you still have had the knowledge to rebuild, even from more or less square one?
Not exactly. Our ship was gravely damaged in battle, then more in the crash landing. But survival called for more than mere adaptation. We also had to hide, because we had no way of knowing whether our enemy could track us here or not. Earth of that era was utterly primitive. To use any fragment of our technology would have amounted to broadcasting our presence. If the enemy had once come into Earth orbit, it would have stood out like what you'd call a sore thumb.
But that knowledge is coming back, isn't it?
She smiled and brushed hair from between her face and him.
I said you were far more perceptive than others generally give you credit for.
How? And maybe more important, why? Why now?
Our ship, you must understand, was itself a living thing. A created sentience. A self-aware being.
Living steel? An intelligent computer?
That's part of it, but more than that. He was the ship, and he lived, even as you or I live. And though he was grievously injured, he formed a desperate plan. And when he spoke of it to the survivors, all of us agreed to it. This process took 10 years.
You folks don't rush into much, do you?
Are you familiar with the Internet, Grant?
What?
The Internet. Triple W, ISPs, P2P, HTM.
Yeah, we were taught some of its history. And the Baronies used something similar to communicate among themselves.
Good. You know that if, for example, you wish to send a message across the country, it was broken down into tiny pieces called packets, and it was then copied and all the copies sent by different routes to be reassembled at their destination.
Yeah, but shouldn't Nabi be telling me this?
This is my province, the law of the people. Strange as that seems, Nabi could tell you how to build an internet. I know, in outline, how it works. Do you know why it was designed that way?
Yeah, we were taught that, too. It was originally intended to allow communications to reliably go through even if a nuclear war zeroed out most of the COMO infrastructure. Of course, they didn't exactly reckon on how much nuclear war they'd get.
You have the concept cold. Redundancy, dispersion, reassembly upon command. And this was done to our souls, by the ship.
To your souls?
I was broken apart. All of us were. The pieces were scattered across a continent.
How?
The soul pieces were assembled into pseudo-personalities. Artificial souls. Perhaps you see why we are not patronizing when we tell you there is much to our lore that your language cannot express. There is much our language can barely hint at. This was done through the medium of the dream time.
Grant's customary scowl deepened, but from concentration, not annoyance.
So, when one of you died...
The fragments were reabsorbed into Jukurpa. Then, in the fullness of time, they were reassembled to form another temporary soul. The components of our real selves stayed separated for over 700 centuries. Now they are being gathered together, reassembled into their original forms.
You mean to tell me...
That I'm 75,000 years old. Yes, as are all of us whom you've encountered so far. All of us who've survived. I am continually reborn, and yet I'm not. I'm different. The me I remember, shadowy as that memory is, was a different person. I carry the weight of 3,000 generations. The parts that are now me have participated in literally thousands of lives, hundreds of thousands. Even though the elders decreed that things must never change, and though we were reshaped to ensure that nothing would change, in 75,000 years, things change, and things happen that were never anticipated. The European invasion. For the first time, we received a substantial infusion of alien genetic material. New lives, new souls were brought within our ambit. At the same time, some of us wandered far and were lost. The elders tried to prepare for such events as best they could, and they were very wise. Each packet into which my soul was split was copied several times over before being dispersed, and so the copies have been passed along. I'm sure some have been lost, some pieces of me, bits of information. Yet I feel whole and alive, in a sense that I have not known for millennia, in any of the male and female forms that I have had.
For a time, they sat side by side in silence as the night solidified.
What about your body?
How do you mean that?
I mean, hell, you're right about our language. Damned if I know how to say this. How about the original occupant? From what we've seen, from what you've told me, all this reassembling is a recent development. This body wasn't born with you inside, is what I'm trying to say, I think.
I have to use a computer metaphor again, and it's not a good one, I'm first to admit. The packets that make up this body's birth personality were taken apart and redistributed to recreate the original personalities of the crew.
But what about the person your body used to be?
She shrugged.
She's dead?
She no longer exists as such. It was a destiny.
Well, that seems pretty damn cold. So you just got zapped into somebody else's body? Just like that?
Rita shook her head, smiling ruefully.
It's not that simple. What's different about me from the way I was when I was disassembled is the mingling of my essence with the residue of the former soul that occupied the body. These transactions take place, ultimately, on a cell-by-cell basis. That's something Nobby could explain much better.
I'll chill him if he tries. I know there's plenty you're not telling me. Hell, I know there's questions I should be asking. Stuff it could be important to know, but if you tell me any more right now, my brain'll explode and come squirting out my ears.
Oh, we wouldn't want that.
She stood and reached a hand out to help him up. He looked up at her, then grasped her, forearm to forearm. She drew him upright as if he were no more than a child.
There's no point in my trying to seduce you tonight, is there?
No.
A As the crowd's chants of bloodlust began to crescendo, Baron Thulia, the appointed emissary of the Nine Baronies, sneezed into a silk handkerchief. Daubing at his face, Thulia glanced over his shoulder in irritation and revulsion at the lower-grade hybrids packed into the pierced ivory pavilion behind the God King's portable throne. He personally had little contact with sub-baron hybrids in North America, although, of course, he knew of their existence. He found these unnerving. For one thing, they refused to speak or allow that they understood English, though Thulia was certain they did both. Certainly the God King was more than fluent. And anyway, their gobbling, mewling, gibbering speech creeped him out.
Is our sport not to your liking, then, my esteemed visitor?
It's not that. Not that at all, Your Majesty. It's more the climate which disagrees with me, I'm afraid.
Even with the heat and humidity and the pain in his sinuses, not to mention total immersion in the indescribable reek of all the sweaty, over-agitated apekin jammed into the plaza, he felt a desperate desire not to give offense to his host. He had a terrifying image, which he could not altogether purge from his mind, that if he did, he would be seized by the Dewa Raja's hybrid retainers, the hooded ones, and they would carry him off through the trapdoor and down the steps, which were the only means of access to the divine pavilion, and he would never be seen again. The God King smiled languidly.
I sorrow that we lack the means to modify things more to your liking, cousin.
The God King seemed uncommonly solicitous today. Perhaps he was warming to Thulia. Since that appeared unlikely, the North American Baron considered the possibilities. That he was either prone to spells, as so many of the barons appeared to be, or was trying to put him off his guard, preparatory to doing something unspeakable to him. They were, he understood glumly, in no way mutually exclusive. The world may not love an underdog, except the way sharks love a wounded grouper, but everybody loves a winner. The crowd was cheering as a whole squad of attendants trotted off, bearing the still semi-conscious Bandu by his many limbs. Domi was up on the dais with Kane, managing to hop and hug him at once, while he finished mopping sweat and less pleasant substances from his face. Gathering his wits, he gave her an affectionate appearing but stinging swat on her felt-clad fanny.
Security, scoot.
Her ruby eyes were huge above her veil.
Sorry, double-stoop me.
She scampered down and into the churning mob. A shadow fell across Kane's face. He turned his head to discover it had been cast by the extravagant black turban of one of the two local mags who had come up onto the dais. The eyes staring at him above the scarlet-trimmed black silk of their veils glittered at him like jet cabochons.
Come with. You be presented to God King now.
Kane nodded. It seemed the safest thing to do. The two tall, black-veiled sekmen led Kane off the back of the platform and onto a path marked by a crimson carpet fringed in gold. It led to the pavilion, which Kane now saw to be made of sheets of ivory, carefully unrolled by artisans from great tusks, flattened, pierced, and figured with exquisite skill. The pyramidal roof was some white stone, possibly alabaster, cut to thin sheets, so that even from without, Kane thought that they must be translucent. Above the gazebo towered a structure whose scale Kane, with certain other claims pressing upon his attention, had not really appreciated until now. The facade rose a good 100 feet above the plaza. It had a whole story of foundation and wide marble steps flanked by great gleaming blocks of stone before one even reached the shadowed portico of squat, slightly convex-sided pillars made of what appeared to be rose granite. The talwar-toting magistrates stopped him a little over 2 yards shy of the pavilion. It was just far enough that his eyes wouldn't focus through the looped and scrolled piercings of the walls, especially since within was shadowed and dim.
The God King, ruler over the waters, subduer of pirates and bringer of plenty to the devastation, salutes you for your performance, Captain Hardin.
It was a prepared speech, but the effect was only spoiled when the herald hesitated, obviously to read the victor's name off something. Kane covered his right fist with his left, the way he had seen some other contestants do, and bowed from the waist, not low. He had to do something, or blow the whole scam right here and now, although even an entirely pro forma bow to a baron made his guts, still sore from Bandu's punch, knot up inside him. He hoped he wouldn't be compelled to bend the knee to the creature. He wasn't. He straightened. Faintly, a liquid, sibilant bubbling sounded from the other side of that ivory screen. The hair rose on Kane's nape, There was no mistaking its source. It was the gobbling, giggling speech of low-level hybrids. He could see hints of them now, pallid faces and splayed hands pressed against the ivory screen. By dint of enormous effort, Thulia restrained himself from swatting at the hybrids crowding around him with no respect for his person. Although he towered above them, he knew it would have done him no good, especially not with the local baron, who, after all, chose to surround himself with the creatures. Not for the first time since beginning this dreadful exile to the hell of the South Seas, he wondered at the concept, article of faith, really, that hybrids were all significantly more intelligent than ape men. These certainly didn't act it. But then, Baron Thulia had little direct experience with them, except as mostly silent and ever so respectful technicians applying the periodic treatments beneath Archuleta Mesa. He got a little misty-eyed over those halcyon days, before the facility was laid waste by the monsters in apekin form who had gone rogue from Cobaltville. Behind him, the human herald looked up from the saucer of moist clay into which the victor's name had been scribbled with a stylus. Paper got too soggy to readily take ink in this humidity, and the Dewa Raja was clearly unwilling to employ technology at the level of handheld computers, this close to his sweaty public. Thulia's eyes narrowed, focusing on the winner of the day's barbaric contest, who stood scant yards away, sweating like a beast. His brief nostalgic excursion had brought a hint of awareness bubbling to the back of his conscious mind. Frustratingly, it floated and danced just out of reach. Can it be possible I've seen this man before? The unseen herald's voice continued announcing,
"You have earned the rank of captain in the Grand Holy Fleet. You have thus confirmed the rank that you bore in the Sultan of Singapore's own rifles, and may, at your discretion, advance to the next level of the tournament to compete for higher rank and great, great prizes."
A big guy with a shaved head and queue hanging down his wedge-shaped back, not too different from Bandu's do, stepped forward.
"Hail, Captain Harden. I am Tuan Parang, once privileged to serve as chief of the Dewa Raja's personal guard, now Vice Raja of Tanimbar. It will be an honor and a pleasure to serve beside a man such as you have shown yourself to be."
He was clearly a politician. Had to be to have a job like this. And yet the forthright way he spoke, and the way his dark brown eyes held Kane's gray ones as he spoke them, made the outlander suspect halfway he meant them. The viceroy thrust out his right arm. After the briefest surprise-born hesitation, Kane reached out in return. The crowd went crazy all over again as they gripped each other, forearm to forearm, dark against pale, even as Kane had often exchanged hand clasps with his blood brother Grant. The renegade mag felt a pang of honest regret he was on the other side from this one. Smiling sternly, Tuan Parang bowed and stepped back. Kane's answering bow was deeper than the one he'd given the unseen God King, as well as more sincere. The crowd quieted to let the herald do his final thing.
"You may now turn, honored Captain Harden of the God King's Holy Army of Retribution, and accept the plaudits of the throng."
Before he could do so, the sound of two hands clapping fell down on his head from above like acid rain. The rising hairs on the back of his neck told him something was badly, badly wrong. Even before he looked up to see a single tall and heavy-set figure in black step forward from the portico above and out to stand, slowly applauding, on the end of the great white gleaming pier of stone over Kane's head. His black garb was not the silk pajamas and outlandish head rag of the local sect men. It was the form-fitting uniform of the magistrate division of a North American barony, with the flash of Cobaltville on the breast and a sin-eater holstered on the left forearm. The mag had a pale, round face that seemed little more than a bent-down terminus to a thick column of neck. The supraorbital ridge was prominent, accented by a single eyebrow like a charcoal smudge, arcing almost from temple to temple. The nose was a shapeless wad of scar tissue. Yet the face's overall impression was almost benign, thick lips set in a sardonic smile, and the dark eyes beneath those atavistic brow ridges glittered with both mocking humor and quick, evil intelligence.
"You picked a strange place to get yourself caught, Kane."
"I guess it figures. With all the humidity and decay around here, a maggot like you would come crawling out into the sunlight, Vladek."
One of the low-tech local magistrates behind him buried a fist in Kane's left kidney. A fountain of scarlet pain seemed to blow out the top of King's spinal column into his brain and blast his consciousness to swarming fragments. He went to his knees. Tuan Parang raised his sculpted handsome face to the foreigner. He frowned. Vladek didn't so much as glance at him.
He had a companion, a woman. Find her and bring her too.
Hands like steel claws grabbed Kane's triceps so cruelly that their pain penetrated the dim red haze of agony in which his consciousness still swam. He was raised halfway up. His legs would not support him as he was dragged up the steps and into the deceptively inviting cool of the great hall beyond. Bridget was sipping coffee. She was leaning back in her commissary chair as if it were actually comfortable, a position out of character for her. It was late at night, at least according to her circadian rhythms, and the automatically dimming lights in the common areas of Cerberus, which otherwise knew neither day and night nor the changing of the seasons. Sally, who was a keen, indefatigable researcher, had turned up some valuable leads from information culled by the astonishingly quick-reading Aborigines. Bridget wanted to pursue those leads as far as she could before fatigue degraded her thinking processes too far to make the effort no longer cost-effective. Caffeine is a crutch, a puritanical voice nagged from the back of her skull, disapproving and packed tight with enclave nanny-think. She moved her shoulders in a soundless laugh. If a crutch is what I need to keep hobbling toward the finish line, then a crutch is what I will use. In front of her, Grant was pacing.
A remarkable story, Grant. I wonder, though...
What? Don't get me wrong. I know she wasn't telling me the whole truth and nothing but. I don't think she lied to me, not as such, although I have to admit my usual instincts for reading people are sometimes way off the mark with this bunch. But...
But even if she did not affirmatively lie to you in what she said, she may have lied most effectively in what she did not.
Exactly.
Bridget frowned, sat forward, holding her cup in both hands as if to draw warmth from it.
I wonder if the ship didn't decay. Maybe it's still buried there beneath the sand near Uluru. Maybe that's the prize they're so afraid of the Barons getting their hands on. There's ample evidence. We've seen that the science the crew possessed before they hid themselves surpasses anything the hybrids have. It's at least as potent as that of the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann, maybe even more. If the Barons were to get their hands on that, I can see why both the Aborigines and we would find that outcome very, very bad.
Then why do they have you and this right woman, and hell, their own selves, going 27 hours out of every 24 looking for a goddamn magic turtle?
I guess we won't know until they find it. I'm beginning to suspect that what looks to us like they're patronizing of us may be right in some ways. I honestly am not sure whether we'd grasp what the turtle truly does if they told us about it.
Are you going to find it?
I think so. We found mention of it, know when and where it came into this country, and some of the places it's been since. It seems to have passed along from collection to collection as if it were hot. I wonder if its mystery powers have something to do with that. Oh, well, given that it's in our records at all, that we've already picked up its chain of provenance... And given that record-keeping grew steadily better and more comprehensive from when it entered America right up until the Long Night, yes, I think we'll find it, and soon.
Why couldn't you all have just done a global search through the database for the keywords Mackenzie Turtle, anyway?
Grant drew himself a mug of coffee. It was his pet mug, an oversized one holding as much as two conventional cups. On the side was enameled the red-gold-green shield and Cyrillic lettering that identified it as originating with the Soviet Border Troops Directorate of the KGB. He had found it on a shelf in a cupboard in Cerberus itself.
Do I try to teach you how to kick down doors, Grant? That was the first thing we tried. It's what generated our first leads. The thing's not always referred to by that name, you see. Often as not, there's only an item number and a description of unpredictable length and accuracy. I wonder how Kane is doing right now.
Shitty was how Kane was doing. The bucket of cold water hitting Kane in the face was like a bucket of cold water hitting him in the face.
Ugh.
He stirred, raised his head from where it hung with chin resting on clavicle. His arms were winged out, up, and behind him in classic crucifixion style, only fastened to a seeping chill stone wall with manacles instead of to a big board with nails. He was hardly aware of the pain in his wrists any longer.
Welcome back to the land of the living, Kane. Enjoy it while you can.
Kane could see nothing at all from his right eye. Not that the vision in his left was great shakes. Without taking any great interest one way or another, he wondered if the eye was out. He had seen beatings hard enough to do it, even himself dealt out a few. And what he'd been getting at the ham-hock hands of Vladek and his burly boy local torturers was up there with the all-time classics, no question of it. Then, with a ripping like an internal membrane giving way, the lid opened, sort of. It had apparently been cemented shut with semi-dried blood. It wouldn't open far. It was probably puffed mostly shut as well. Now he could rejoice in the full, if blurry, glory of his old classmate Vladek. At least he had binocular vision back to triangulate the range for spitting. His best effort fell pitifully short.
You've still got the stones of a true mag, Kane. I have to hand you that. Speaking of which, maybe I will hand them to you. Your stones, that is to say.
Might be better than listening to your bullshit, Vladek. What's the fucking point here, anyway?
As the one-time golden boy of the Cobaltville Magistrate Division, you know pain-based interrogation is unreliable, especially on a trained mag. So you may be forgiven for wondering why I'm doing this. And the answer is fun. Fun and payback for the trouble you've caused your Baron and for all the good mags you chilled. Of course, this is just a down payment. Once you've told me everything you know about your whole treasonous operation and what nasty business brings you skulking around this part of the world, you'll get payment in full, with interest.
He turned, grabbed up a rag from the bronze water pot to wipe away the blood he'd gotten on his hand.
Okay, boys, take him down.
He held up a syringe. A cracked-nailed thumb depressed the plunger. A droplet of clear fluid appeared at the needle tip, like venom on a viper's fang.
It's time he and I had a little talk.
The great and mighty Tuan Parang prepared himself for sleep. The Dewa Raja had displaced him from the grandest quarters of the palace. That meant nothing to him whatsoever. It was only to be expected. And in any event, the only reason the Vice-Raja consented to occupy quarters of such grandiose luxury was that no less was expected of his station as ruler of the Divine Kingdom's Southern March. Besides, his current quarters were scarcely less ostentatious, or even smaller. This was, after all, a palace. He had chased off the last of his body servants. As the most energetic and tireless, not to mention fearless, of the God King's rising young officer corps, he had come eventually to appreciate the necessity of a proper staff. He had more important services to render his God King and his people than tending to his own linen every day. Yet he had only so much tolerance for having them hovering about him incessantly, like stinging flies, he thought. Or the hooded ones the God King drew about him like a swarm everywhere he went these days. They had always been there, from the day of Tuan Parang's first proud introduction to his god and monarch, after he had defeated a daunting number of Wako pirate ships from the islands where the sun is born, off Sunda, with but a single 12-gun war junk and a plague-weakened crew. But then they had hung in the background, like shadows. Now they followed the God King as if they were his shadow. He shrugged as he sat on the edge of his grand canopied extravagance of a bed to pull off his own right boot. He declined to wear sandals, except when going to bathe, believing that whenever awake he should be always prepared to march straight out and onto campaign roads or the quarterdeck of a warship, and even after he got a batman, believed that any soldier ought to be able to take off his own damn boots. Of course, they wore boots of the finest quality, for durability and also softness. Tuan Parang also believed that a soldier's feet no less than his sword were his most vital implements, and to neglect the care of one was as bad as neglecting the care of the other. He smiled as he drew off his other high-topped yellow boot and cast it aside. Perhaps I should not have been so hasty running off all the servants, he thought, or so thorough. There had been among them, as always, more than one fair maid, whose flashing eye made it abundantly clear that it would be her pleasure to serve him. Nor indeed was that strictly because of his power and repute, nor even the hawk-like handsomeness of his face, nor yet the sinewy strength and grace of his body and limbs. He stood to divest himself of his last garments, his loose trousers of scarlet silk. As his hands undid the silken cord that held them, he froze. Automatically, his spatial awareness reminded him of just where the plain but serviceable and comfortable hilt of the sheathed talwar he had hung by the head of the bed lay in relation to a right hand whose calluses had been shaped by years of intimate contact with it. He could not have said which sense revealed the intruder. It was the tiniest sound betraying otherwise faultless stealth, a stirring in the heavy jasmine-scented air, a motion tug at the edge of vision, a tiny, vagrant wisp of odor like the scent of an unfamiliar blossom. He straightened slowly, right hand at ease, thumb and fingers lightly curved, ready. For like any master fighter, he knew relaxation was readier for swift, decisive action than tension ever could be.
"You might as well come out. I know you're there."
In the light cast by a single oil lamp upon its thin brass pedestal by the bed, most of the chamber lay lost in shadows. From behind one of the columns supporting the vaulted ceiling, itself scarcely visible, stepped a figure. Small, slim, yet upright, and swathed from head to foot in a dark hooded cloak. Tuan Parang scowled.
"A hooded one? Let me warn you. Not even being one of the Dewa Raja's pet monkeys excuses you invading my bedchamber thus."
"I crave the great Lord Parang's pardon if I give offense by my intrusion."
To Tuan Parang, the voice held two surprises. The words were in English, and it was unmistakably the voice of a young woman. The tall man couldn't restrain a smile. It was a thin smile, suggesting it might not stretch much farther before snapping.
"You do so offend, woman. How do you propose to win my pardon?"
"I bring before you gifts."
"What gifts are these? You seem empty-handed."
"Rubies and ivory."
The hooded cloak dropped free. Beneath was a woman, and nothing more. Such a woman as he had never seen. And he thought, as master of a substantial swath of the South Sea, that he had seen all the world had to offer in that line. She was clearly an albino. He was more than familiar with albinos, but none like this. From the short, spiky crown of white hair on her head, down past surprisingly full, cherry-tipped breasts, a flat stomach, narrow waist, and flared hips. In fact, a surprising figure for one so slender, to the snowy patch between her thighs, she seemed a figurine sculpted by an unparalleled master to represent a very personification of allure. A flawless idol of ivory. A beauty exquisite enough to stir the most jaded connoisseur. And the eyes fixed upon him with frankly challenging invitation were veritably ruby in hue.
"You did not lie, Ingresi. Are such treasures offered only to please the eye?"
She smiled. It made him instantly hard.
"Not at all, Tuan Basar."
She walked forward, making no more noise than the shadow, trailing her cloak behind. As she came up to him, and he smelled the clean femininity of her, he held up one great scarred hand.
"I know you. You must be the hooded companion of the champion today, Captain Harden."
"I'm that woman."
"Is it not your man who was cast into the dungeon of this very palace, then? Do you not betray him, coming before me thus?"
"Lord Parang, you're a warrior, with honors and power. The God King listens to you. That man who fought today and won is my friend, not my mate. I want you to help him, for me."
Parang frowned, but he stroked his chin with the strong fingers of his sword hand.
"He has displeased the allies of my divine lord. I do not see how any intercession I can make can aid him, even should I grant it."
"Listen to what I tell you, but first, let me get your attention."
K. Kane's whole universe, as he lay strapped to the table, was a red pulsation of pain. He scarcely felt the jab into the side of his left elbow. Instantly, warmth began to flow outward from the site of the injection, soothing, relaxing. A fragment of memory floated to the surface of Kane's disordered brain. He smiled and opened his eyes. They made a cracking sound. Vladek loomed above him like a colossus.
Lucky I brought my chem interrogation kit from Cobaltville. Now we'll find out just what brings a traitor like you to Tarimbar.
Not a chance, Vladek.
What the fuck are you talking about?
You were racked up during chem interrogation training. That was an unfortunate accident.
The scar across Vladek's forehead flushed scarlet.
Don't talk about that! I picked up what I need to know. Have no fear, my friend.
Bullshit. If you had, you'd know about the conditioning.
What conditioning? What are you raving about?
We got a series of injections of standard Magistrate Division truth serum. Built up resistance.
The single eyebrow rose.
Oh, so. Well, we can take care of that.
A little wizened cypress knot of torture tech, naked but for a grimy twist of loincloth, bobbed his shaved head and shuffled forward, bearing a white plastic case marked with the 9-spoked wheel and justice scale emblem of the Magistrate Division. Vladek took forth a fresh injection unit, twisted the blue plastic sheath off the needle tip, and smiled.
We'll just give another dose to the one we hate most.
The bloody bearded lips spread into a wider smile. Then they relaxed. The puffed eyelids fluttered. The gray eyes rolled up until only white showed.
What is it? What's happening?
The loincloth-clad chief torturer to whom Vladek spoke felt with splayed fingertips at the side of Kane's throat, then moistened a finger with a yellowish tongue and held it beneath Kane's nostrils. Then he looked up and spoke words that were gibberish to Vladek.
Dayawana.
The interpreter whom the God King had provided, one of the local-style mags, removed his hood to reveal a cruel, lean, and tan face. His English was perfectly clear.
He says the prisoner sleeps.
Vladek dashed the emptied syringe on the well-worn stones of the torture chamber floor.
Get a bucket of water and wake the fucker up, then! What are you stoop standing around gawking for?
The torturer looked up in alarm. Wagging his head, he babbled a string of agitated syllables.
What? What's he farting through the fucking mouth about now?
The interpreter's dark eyes slitted, but he was a magistrate after all, despite the difference in uniform. His voice was level when he answered.
He says the man is unconscious, drugged out.
The torturer listened, nodding his old bald egg of a head as if he understood. Vladek would not have put it past the little bastard to savvy English perfectly well. Vladek's disgust was complete. If you couldn't trust a torturer not to jack with you, whom could you trust?
If you rouse him, his heart may fail. If you can get to your answers from a dead man, truly, your skills are the greatest ever known.
Back, pressed to the rough, sweating stone wall of the underground passage, Tuan Parang held up a hand. Domi understood the silent command and made no noise. The viceroy was dressed in loose brown pantaloons, a loose white blouse, and a dark blue sash holding the heavy-bladed chopping dagger or short sword that gave him his name on one side and a talwar on the other. Domi had resumed her hooded cloak. She remained naked beneath. As a one-time contract sex toy, Domi had well understood how to find the necessary bedchamber, even though few attendants spoke a language she could understand. Some things, again, were universal. To get to a place where she could show the Vice Raja what she wanted to, however, had required the cooperation of Parang himself. Who better to know the secret ways of the palace than its customary occupant? Having enjoyed the pleasure Domi had promised, Parang had readily agreed to act upon his word and investigate her wild claims instantly. He didn't seem a real deliberative sort. Domi did feel trepidation that the God King would have built into the palace places and passages he never revealed to his satrap, and so cleverly concealed that even in years of occupation, Parang would not find them. But this man seemed to know full well where the hooded ones were generally to be found going about their mysterious business, even at this hour of the night. He already fully mistrusted them, it seemed, although he had no inkling of their real nature. And he had been unwilling to accept at face value Domi's claim that they were demons, as she called them, because she didn't trust her own ability to get the concept across to a man from such a predominantly low-tech culture. The Viceroy was far from stupid, but his mind wasn't the sharpest weapon in his rack. She had chosen to fly solo on this. The Aborigines were nice. They were nice to her, which she was far from accustomed to, even in Cerberus. But maybe too nice for the sort of work that needed to be done, and fast, too prone to ask questions. Besides, Kane was her friend. She'd lost him. She would get him back, big time. Ferret sharp, her ears picked up the shuffling of feet. A moment later, a pair of small figures passed, backs to the humans, cowled, heads bent. A bubbling murmur came from them, distinctly inhuman. Domi actually saw the skin at the back of Parang's neck rumple as some of the human body's few skin muscles reacted to the eeriness of that sound. The pair who had just passed greeted a newcomer going the other way. Domi shrank inside her cloak, and a hand sought an interior pocket. The figure shuffling into view had its head down likewise, features obscured within the folds of its hood. Quite possibly it could not see them. In any event, taking for granted the sanctity of the dungeons beneath the palace, it was oblivious to the possibility of danger. At least, until some unknown stimulus made it raise its bowed head. In time for Parang's fist to obscure its whole field of vision like a falling moon. Domi's first reaction was concern that her companion might have killed the hybrid. Then it occurred to her she didn't really care. It would have to be restrained from raising the alarm one way or another. If it died now, well, that was life in the Outlands, even ones as outlandish as these. But Parang was a man well-versed in all the nuances of mayhem, and he had, as Goldstein had told of him during his briefing, and as could be heard repeated in every souk in the city, a sense of justice as fine-tuned as his fighting skills. It was not his way to slay those whom he wasn't certain deserved it, any more than it was to hesitate putting the whack on those who did. The figure Parang dragged by a handful of its robe back down the hall and into a tiny storeroom that he opened with an apparent master key carried in his sash was clearly still breathing, only stunned. Closing the door softly, Parang laid the hybrid on the flagstones. Age-darkened barrels stood stacked around them. The storeroom smelled of must and mildew, but there were no clues as to what the casks contained. Domi knelt quickly to pull the hood down from the unmoving creature's head.
Veritably it is so.
He looked at her with wonder in his eyes and not a little fear, an expression Domi doubted very many others had ever seen there.
You have spoken truth, Perumpuanputi.
There was no room for skepticism, nor any need to display more of the unconscious creature. That outsized head with the elongated cranium, the small yet not unappealing features, the huge eyes, now half-lidded, the downy wisps of brown hair along the gleaming expanse of skull. Humanoid they were, but inarguably not human.
These are the evil creatures who have clouded the God King's mind with their spells. Even a divinity might be fooled by them.
Whoa, listen to yourself, girl, she thought, and silently blessed Bridget Baptiste for encouraging her to read.
It might not be seemly to take counsel of a mere woman and a mere Ingrazia at that. Yet I am a man who prizes results, and would never have gotten where I am had I spurned wisdom when I found it. So, oh fair one, where would you lead me from here?
Bridget Baptiste's green eyes bulged slightly at the image on the screen of the terminal in the commissary. Audiovisual feed from the command center was being patched through it.
Lakesh?
The large-headed figure was naked but for a sort of diaper about the loins. He had swirls of red and yellow paint daubed on his chest, face, and upper arms.
Who else might I be? Oh, yes, I see. Forgive it, dearest Bridget. Old Man and Yindi are initiating me to some of the mysteries of Chukorpa.
He nodded his head back toward where a number of mostly naked figures danced around a nocturnal bonfire. Bridget felt aftershocks of the vision Yindi had shown to her, Domi, and Shizuka months before, felt a loosening of her joints and unease in the pit of her stomach.
Behind me, you see a korobori in progress, which is to say...
A ritual to invoke the guidance of the elders.
To be sure, to be sure. Yet, since there is none elder than Old Man, the ritual, like the Dreamtime itself, has taken on a new significance, or at least a new nuance. Let me expatiate.
None older than Old Man? But the souls of the original crew are re-inhabiting the bodies of the living, and they're all 75,000 years old at the least.
Lakesh's eyes blinked in a mixture of surprise and disappointment.
You know about that?
She nodded. Old Man himself crowded into the picture with Lakesh.
It appears some of my colleagues have been talkative.
Lakesh scowled, and for a moment Brigid thought a shoving match would ensue. Not without hope that it would. But Old Man ignored the scientist, which no doubt rankled Lakesh most of all. Old Man was grinning all over his round, weathered head, though, indicating he bore no rancor to whichever of the four working with Baptiste and Grant might have spilled the sacred beans.
They have.
Brigid declined to be specific, just in case. She had lived too long under constant threat of informers in the Koboldville enclaves to rat out Rita.
Well, it doesn't seem to have driven you mad. No harm, no foul, as the saying goes.
I'm glad you feel that way. Still, given that we are working together, not to mention facing danger together, don't you think a bit more candor might be appropriate?
Oh, no. We don't want to dole out too much too quickly. It's for your own good, of course. We have no desire to alarm you, nor yet to undermine your self-confidence.
There's no need to be priggish about it, Brigid. We have decided upon the course we think best for all concerned.
The tall, flame-haired senior archivist felt a pang of deep desire to partake of the arcane skills of a farwalker so that she could reach through the screen, grab the two old men by their scrawny, wattled throats, and give them both a good shake.
Thank you so much for your confidence, Doctor.
Just as some people don't understand English when it doesn't suit them to, so Lakesh possessed a selective and convenient deafness to irony.
It is nothing, dear Brigid. I have full faith in your abilities, as well as those of your new protege, Sally Wright. Speaking of which, let me not forget the original purpose of my call. How goes this search for the turtle?
He knew how to press her buttons, stifling her annoyance by invoking the iron-bound discipline of the professional in her. Damn him anyway.
It goes. We can establish its location as late as the mid-1950s. However, a physical search revealed it is not still where it was then. We turned up some water-damaged records that some of the moon-based scientists believe they can restore sufficiently to derive at least some information from them, however. We are expecting results at any time.
Good, good. Press onward. It's absolutely vital that we recover the artifact as quickly as possible. Time is pressing. Kane's Aborigine companions report that the God King's preparations to invade Australia are quite advanced. Speaking of which, what do you hear from Kane?
Nothing. He's fallen off our scopes. We have lost all trace of his biolink transceiver.
She had been at some pains to hide the fact from Grant, who would have insisted on herring off after Kane himself, regardless, doing Kane and everybody else precisely no good. The Aboriginal team accompanying Kane and Domi acknowledged concern, in their perpetually cheerful way, but they were unwilling to take action until they heard something concrete from Domi, whose own transceiver showed she was still in Tanimbar City. In fact, her biometrics had recently showed a most distinctive spike of intense physical activity. Lakesh was as mellow as the Aborigines.
Our friend Kane can take care of himself, to understate the case grandly. I wouldn't count him out just yet, Brigid, my very dear.
A figure came up behind him and touched him lightly on the arm. It was a woman, and even in the poor nighttime light and beneath the paint, Brigid could see that for all her characteristically marked Aborigine features, she was more than handsome. And her own loincloth did nothing to conceal the fact she possessed a body to die for. Lakesh looked up, smiled when he saw her. She said something the audio pickups didn't convey. Lakesh climbed to his feet with alacrity, which almost suggested that the fading rejuvenation Sam the Imperator had bestowed upon him was kicking in again.
I must return to the ceremony. Now, if you'll excuse me.
The screen went blank. Brigid's palm slammed down on the table next to the keyboard, causing Collins and several Moonies, taking their morning coffee break a discreet distance away, to stare at her. She ignored them.
That randy old goat! Ceremony my...
Doctor! That is, Brigid?
Yes, Sally, what is it?
Her habit of self-control enabled her not to snap at the self-effacing new archivist.
I hate to disturb you, but I...
She glanced nervously at the others in the commissary, then stole up to Bridget's side as if hoping they wouldn't see her. For her part, Bridget glared at the others, putting all the energy of her still vigorous annoyance with Lakesh into green death eye beams. Collins and the Moonies looked hastily away. Sally leaned low to speak softly toward Bridget's left ear.
I just thought of something most disturbing, Bridget. It's impossible for the Aborigines to have come from Earth's past.
So, my trusted Viceroy has allowed his curiosity to get the better of his loyalty to me.
I don't think it's his curiosity he's being led around by, God King.
Vladek ignored Baron Thulia, who stood with them in an antechamber to the God King's sleeping room, watching a monitor displaying images captured by one of the very few select and hidden video cams the God King had secreted within the Tanimbar Palace. The magistrate's voice was brusque, as if he was unaware of speaking to a superior being. Baron Thulia longed to see him slapped down for it. He'd do it himself, but his allergies were acting up again, and the creature was really quite intimidating in his brutishly physical apekin way. The Dewa Raja seemed not even to notice, which rankled Thulia even more, given how imperiously the local baron had insisted he, Thulia, render him due submission. Vladek stabbed a blunt finger at the hooded figure that followed Parang as the tall man dragged the hybrid he had just stunned down the hallway.
That's a woman. It's got to be the one who was with Cain earlier today, yesterday. Who in turn is damn near certain to be a renegade outlander criminal named Domi. Albino bitch. Professionally speaking, she's a damn gaudy slut.
Indeed.
With your permission, God King, I'll jump back to Cobaltville with the renegade. We have proper interrogation facilities there.
You do not have my permission, Magistrate. When the ape man awakens, I will question him personally to ensure that no further errors are made.
Vladek's scar flared scarlet.
At least let me pull in the bitch in Parang.
My sensors indicate they have returned to Lord Parang's bedchambers. I will see to their disposition. You may withdraw, Magistrate.
But
I have acceded to your presence. It is even possible that you might still prove of use despite your mishandling of the chemical interrogation. But I will not be argued with. If you persist, I will have you flayed alive.
For a moment, Vladek hung there, his rage so quiveringly palpable that Thulia dared hope he'd go ahead and vent it and incur the promised punishment. Instead, the magistrate spun and stamped from the chamber. The God King cocked a slender, moon-pale finger. A hooded one appeared.
Summon Bandu. It is time he redeemed himself.
Tuan Parang sat on his rumpled bed, turning the long, slender, silvery metallic object Domi had taken from the stunned hybrid. It was an infrasound wand.
This is all very strange.
Domi felt a certain sympathy for him. She understood how hard it was for such a man to admit to the slightest weakness, including, perhaps especially, that peculiarly unmanning variety, doubt. She lay beside him with her ass upturned like two scoops of French vanilla ice cream. Watching the way he subconsciously ran his strong fingers up and down the wand was stirring her appetites. She licked her lips. Get a grip, she told herself sternly. Duty calls. She would never feel the same intense bond to Cain as she did to his comrade Grant. But the dark-haired chiller with the wolf-gray eyes was still her comrade, part of the only family she had in all the world.
With magic this strong, no wonder the demons can put spells on the God King.
She had demonstrated the potency of the infrasound wand earlier by using it to blast the unconscious hybrid's head to jelly before Parang's eyes. Superstition tinged with dread had overcome Parang's sense of honor toward a helpless captive. As far as feral girl Domi was concerned, it was getting good use from a bad enemy. Parang nodded. An uncomfortable mass of thought was weighing visibly upon him.
Yet where does my duty lie? I cannot act against the hooded ones without acting counter to the wishes of my liege.
She frowned, since he wasn't looking at her face.
But the Dewa Raja does not know the truth. Doesn't your duty make you chill the ones who have control of your God King's mind?
If only I could be certain.
A shadow fell across the bed. Domi and Tuan Parang looked around to see a 7-foot-tall apparition standing just inside the spill of orangish lamplight, with a sickle-bladed sword gleaming in each of its 4 black-nailed hands.
And now,
you die!
Bandu charged, curved swords held wide to slice. Naked sword blades as a universal language. Domi lunged half off the bed. Her right hand dived into her hooded robe, which lay in a mound on the floor. Tuan Parang was grabbing for his talwar hanging in its scabbard at the bed's head. It was painfully clear he wouldn't get it out in time. Bandu closed for the kill. Domi rolled back onto the bed with her arm held out straight. Bandu's eyes went wide. Clutched in Domi's tiny white fist was a stubby semi-automatic pistol, her Detonix combat blaster. Big muzzle flashes underlit a very surprised expression on Bandu's rugged features in yellow as the naked albino woman dumped 8 180-grain beveled ashcan hollow points into the Biofac's naked chest. The pistol slide locked back.
I triple hope that chilled you. That's all there is and there ain't no more.
Still on his feet, Bandu's exhalation vented out several of the holes in his chest with bubbling little squeals and foamings of pink lung blood. He dropped to his knees with a thump.
You are a woman of many surprises.
Domi brandished her slide-locked blaster.
I'm a woman of no more magazines. Better not be any more bad guys.
It was the wrong thing to say. Four of the local talent mags, black-turbaned and veiled, rushed from the shadows of Tuan Parang's bedchamber. As they converged on the half-naked Vice Raja with swords drawn, he stooped, caught up the four-foot-tall bedside pedestal lamp near its base and swung it like a club at his leading attacker. Reflexively, the man threw up his talwar to block the blow of the improvised club. His sharp steel sliced the thin, soft brass stalk cleanly through. The boat-shaped lamp itself tumbled, struck his cloth-wrapped head, and burst open. Yellow fire cascaded down the whole left side of his body like a fast, hot flow of lava. As the man commenced to thrash and scream, Parang sidestepped the overhand cut of the next black-clad Stoneheart, then stepped past him, extending his left arm and turning it over so that the back of his wrist struck the onrushing man in the sternum. The burning man was staggering about, arms extended, dripping flame and shrieking. Evidently, the local magistrate academy didn't teach stop, drop, and roll. The two black-clad chillers still on their feet fanned out to take Tuan Parang in a pincers movement. They were big men. They moved with panther confidence. They were two to his one and wore armor beneath their loose black blouses. Tuan Parang aimed a savage whistling backhand cut at eye level of the man approaching from his right. It had no chance of connecting. The swordsman was too far away, but instinctively the mag rocked his balance back to pull his head out of harm's way, killing his forward momentum. Parang, meanwhile, had rolled his right wrist and reversed direction with blinding speed. As the man to his left cocked his own sword arm for a cut, the Vice Raja's talwar described a sine wave, rising and then slashing transversely down. The curve of the blade concentrated all the stroke's force on a very small arc of blade. It sheared through the man's turban and the thin steel skullcap beneath to lop away his skull from the left side of his forehead to right temple. The speed of his own blade scarcely slowed, Parang brought it high and down to meet the right-hand attacker, who had resumed his charge. Steel rang on steel as the man's own cut turned into a desperate parry. Too fast for the eye to follow, they exchanged three singing strokes. Then Parang's blade swept in a horizontal arc, and the black-turbaned head popped free of its neck in a blood geyser. The man whom Parang had clotheslined was behind him, sword raised for the killing stroke. The viceroy spun, but without hope of preventing the blade from entering his own flesh.
Wand!
Domi lay on her belly, pointing the hybrid blaster with both hands. Then she pivoted and fired another invisible infrasound blast at the man whom Parang had set afire, who was turning in place in shrieking, blazing circles.
Quiet now, but still smells bad.
Jumping off the bed, she quickly rolled her empty detonix in her robe. Tucking it under her left arm, wand in her right hand, she stood and looked at Parang.
We get Kane from dungeon now, yes?
Even standing there with chest heaving, face and torso splashed with blood and brains and gore dripping from his blade in clots, he ran an appreciative eye down her nakedness. Then he grinned.
I think this means I am discharged from the Dewa Raja's service.
That's a yes.
Neither the dungeon keeper nor the two black-clad guards keeping watch over the prisoner who hung unconscious from the wall by his wrists thought anything when they heard the key turn in the lock of the heavy iron-bound teakwood door. Then a great lean tiger of a man burst in, half-naked and smeared with blood, followed by an entirely nude woman whose skin was the color of the full moon at midnight. The black-clad guardsmen were still gaping when Tuan Parang chopped them down. The dungeon keeper, a squat, brown, shaved-headed man in a dusky orange robe, fell to his knees and beseeched Tuan Parang, pleading for his life. Domi looked around, found an iron bar resting on the rim of a brazier filled with coals burned down to gray ashes and cooled. She took it up, hefted it experimentally, then clouted the dungeon keeper across the bare pate with it from behind. He fell over, curled into a fetal position, clutching at his split and blood-spurting scalp with both hands, mewling and kicking his sandaled feet in agony. Parang frowned at the naked woman.
Why did you do that? He is a friend.
Why I did it saved his life. We chain up now. God King doesn't blame him later for losing number one prize prisoner.
You are a very clever young woman. Too clever, perhaps.
No second thoughts time now.
She pulled the jailer's bloody hands away from his wounded head, yanked them behind his back, and secured them with a set of manacles as deftly as any mag. Then she tossed him quickly and came up triumphantly, brandishing a set of keys. These she took over to where Kane hung slumped with his head dangling to his chest. She undid first one wrist and then the other. Tuan Parang was there to help her ease Kane's not inconsiderable weight to the floor.
Thank you.
She fetched a half-full bucket from beside a nearby wall.
Hope this water, not shit.
She then dashed the contents into Kane's face. It was water. It ran pink down his face and into his beard and dripped onto his chest.
Back so soon, Vladek? You must have missed me.
No such luck. Only me and Tuan Parang.
The gray eyes snapped wide open.
Domi?
In the flesh.
So I see.
Kane sat up, rubbing at the back of his skull.
What the hell are you doing down here, buck naked, with the Vice Raja?
Saving your ungrateful ass. You don't like? We go away. Leave you to male bond with Big Pig Vladek.
You are a lucky man, friend. This one has done much and dared all for you. Yet she says she is not even your mate.
No. We're both spared that. Loyalty's a strong suit of hers. Unlike modesty or tact.
Tuan Parang reached a hand down to Kane.
I don't know who you people are. But if all your folk are like you, I do not know why you don't rule the world.
Only 2-3 more people like us.
And we wouldn't rule the world if you gave it to us on a plate. We just don't want to let the hybrids keep it any longer.
Hybrids?
Demons.
Thanks, friend. And thank you too, Domi, so you don't whine.
We must get you out of the palace quickly. Soon the God King will realize his assassins failed to take the Lord Choppa, and the alarm will be raised.
Quick and easy. I'll call our friends.
Not in here. Can't. Vladek bragged. Old dungeon surrounded with metal. Faraday cage. Blocks radio signals.
Okay, let's go out in the hall. Mary Alice can whisk us all right out of here.